up about 11.5% from a year earlier. American Bankruptcy Institute figures also show filings nationwide increased 14% in the first 6 months of 2010 compared to last year. The Taste of Minnesota lost money and attracted smaller crowds this year, despite a host of changes aimed at improving the St. Paul Festival. Laura Ewan reports.
Organizers pumped new life into the four-day event on Harriet Island by booking big-name bands, such as the Counting Crows and the Offspring. But they also charged up to $30 in admission. Until last summer, the event was free. Co-owner Andy Ferris says he needs to look at his business strategy. Since he took over 2 years ago, the festival has not turned a profit.
Part of any business is evaluating performance, and we are going to evaluate what went right and what went wrong.
Ferris says sweltering heat and the weak economy kept the crowds away over the weekend. Up to 20% fewer people came to the festival than in previous years. Ferris says music fans appreciated the changes and the event was more secure. St. Paul police say arrests and incidents have gone down over the past two summers. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A questionable art sculpture removed from a Bemidji downtown walkway will be returned following protests of artistic censorship. City Manager John Chatton removed the sculpture after some people expressed concerns that the painted art piece showed a portion of the female anatomy. Its creator, Deborah Davis, says her painted sculpture shows Mother Earth praying with roses coming from her hands. The Bemidji City Council voted last night at a packed meeting to return the art piece to the Bemidji Sculpture Walk. Showers and thunderstorms likely in southern and eastern Minnesota this afternoon. Right now in the Twin Cities, it's partly sunny. The temperature is 78. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Support for this program comes from CenterPoint Energy, offering cost-effective, environmentally friendly natural gas for home and water heating. For more information, including an energy costs and emissions calculator, you can visit centerpointenergy.com/gas is better.
Streaks of earth. Down, but she won't scare. Blinks her eyes, battered green and blue. Ignorance can leave a
Jeremy Messersmith told a blogger recently that he occupies, quote, some sort of nether region of music. Indie labels think his stuff sounds too much like made-for-radio pop, and the big dogs don't think it's poppy enough. But if he was marching to the tune of some record exec, would he have been able to make a whole album about death and dying?
No, you don't.
The album is titled The Reluctant Graveyard. Jeremy Messersmith joins us along with two other musicians in the Maud Moon Weyerhaeuser studio. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
You laughed when you heard me revive that quote about the nether region of music. Did you know that that was going to come back to haunt you in some way?
No, I didn't realize that was going to happen.
That I would dig it up and unearth it somewhere. I thought that was very interesting because you didn't say that, at least it didn't look like this in the interview, where you were like, I'm frustrated about this, I occupy this nether region of music. You seemed quite comfortable with that.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it or anything. I kind of make the music I want to make, and where it falls isn't really up to me. That's sort of where everybody else is at.
Well, so how would you define what nether region of music actually is?
I guess I would say anything that you can't dance to, but maybe is slightly catchy. Yeah.
Okay.
You can't really dance to my stuff, and I usually aim for lyrical content that, just maybe doesn't insult your intelligence, and that's kind of the bar I set for it. And it's usually you have either, well, something you can dance to.
Right.
Or you have something which is maybe a little more avant-garde, say, mm-hmm. like most indie music. And I think I'm just kind of somewhere in between, and nobody knows really what to do, including me.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about that. So is that the place where your career could be? Or is it a place that at some point is going to limit what you do with your career?
It might end up limiting. I guess I'm not really sure. I think I have a love of pop music. I have a love of, hit songs. But I love indie stuff too. And the thing about pop music is half the time I just kind of feel stupid for listening to it. And
it's your guilty pleasure?
I try to pull from both of them into something. But we'll see. I may need to be either, for my next project, it might need to be just super dancey pop hits, or it needs to just be, 20-minute songs and, really obtuse lyrics.
You're the first musician, I think, that's come in here to say that they feel stupid for listening to a certain kind of music.
Yeah, I mean, I try not to, but I'll dance to Lady Gaga, but, I don't feel good about myself.
Why not?
Well, I realize these songs are just so engineered to make me dance or move around.
Yeah. They're too calculated? Is that the deal? And you're responding to the naked calculation of that music?
Lady Gaga feels to me like when you walk into a movie theater and you see a poster and it has like a woman falling off of a building shooting like machine guns and there's explosions kind of going on.
You know it's
going to
be great.
Yeah, it's just there's nothing really subtle about it. It's sort of like being hit on the head with a hammer for a while. And I don't know. At the same time, I listen to it, so I don't know what I'm talking about.
As I was thinking about this, I was thinking that you're an interesting contradiction here, and we're going to talk about the scavenger hunt that you guys created for the release of this new album. But you're savvy about how to market yourself and your music, especially online, and yet you're the first to admit that write 11 or 12 songs about death and dying and put them on an album, and that isn't necessarily going to be some big seller.
No, there's a career suicide, there. Really. I think it's a mix of, I don't really get to pick the songs that I write, and
what does that really mean?
Well, half the time I feel like I'm not really in control of what I end up writing or thinking about anyway. I kind of pursue whatever I think is interesting and makes me sort of happy.
Yeah, but a song could come to you and you'd think, if I'm going to write, am I really going to write 12 songs here about death and put them all together on an album?
Yeah.
You do have some control over that.
That is true. I do choose what gets put on a record.
Yeah.
And I guess I decided to put out this one because I thought, I don't really know anybody else who's done a whole record about death and dying other than metal bands. So why not give it a try?
So come back to me. Come back on that idea that you've kind of hit a sweet spot with the way you market. It's clever what you do online, and yet you're producing this music that you know isn't necessarily going to be some big seller.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the cleverness is just because we don't have a whole lot of other options.
On marketing, you mean?
Sure, on marketing. I mean, there's no record label or somebody with big pockets who, funds this stuff. It's usually just kind of me, sitting at a computer, and it's like, there's all these new tools available for artists to use, and I should really try to use as many of them as possible.
So what if there were some record executives saying, we can't take 12 songs about death?
Well, I'd say, give me a couple months, I'll try to write some more songs.
You would?
And, well,
oh,
no.
You'd sell out
no.
so easily, I knew it.
Well, I'd sell out for, a good hot dog. I mean, who knows? But I don't know. I mean, as far as I can tell, label people who have heard my stuff have been like, yeah, it's good. It's really good. Good luck. So I don't know really. I think it's maybe I just don't fit into one of those sort of easily packaged archetypes, and so I do stuff how I want to do it, which is pretty great.
Tell me a little bit about the scavenger hunt that you guys created for the release of the album.
Sure.
How'd that work?
Well, it worked. I had my friend, collaborator / producer guy, Andy Thompson.
Who's here?
Who's here?
Hey,
sitting
Andy.
Over there.
Hello.
He's sort of a riddle master, and he's big into like games and that sort of thing. And we thought, hey, let's do a scavenger hunt. Well, we'll hide stuff all over the Twin Cities, like before the record came out. So some CDs, some tapes, even a test vinyl copy, and some pretty cool stuff. And let's write some riddles which are related to the record and see if anybody can find them.
So, Andy, can you remember one of the riddles that you wrote?
Oh, man. I could look it up on Twitter. That's how we...
is that how you did it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't think I could recite
so
one.
So would the riddles be in some kind of rhyme, or they would just be, you know...
Just little four-line poems, yeah.
This is great. Yeah.
And I thought they were just about incomprehensible. I was like, there is no way I would figure this out. And then, an hour later, somebody would show up at the spot, and they would already have it cracked.
They solve these riddles that fast?
Yep. Yeah. There was one guy in particular who was just a master. And he would solve them eventually and be like, I got it, but I'm not going to go get it. I'm going to let somebody else get it.
Uh-huh. I'll let the little people see if they can figure it out.
Yeah.
Or else I'd have every little gift that you hid around
exactly.
the Twin Cities, right?
He was very kind in that way.
Here's one of the other things you did that I thought was interesting. You actually consulted your online audience about how to sing. Certainly. I thought when I read that, man, that is a slippery slope. Where does that end?
I don't know. I mean, it wasn't like, should I sing this whole song in falsetto or something? But when you're in the studio and you're working, you're making stuff, there's like, 100 little decisions you have to make every day. And maybe some of them matter more than other ones. And,
like what?
Well, like, should I play this guitar part down low? Should I play it up high? Should, what microphone should I use on this or that?
But I think we expect you, the musician, the artist, the creative, to know that.
Yeah, and that's true to a point, but it was nice to be able to bring like a completely objective opinion. I'm totally biased. I mean, I've sort of written these songs, and sometimes you need a little outside perspective. And so it was nice to be able to say, should I sing this word like may or me? And everybody was like, oh, well, sing it me.
It
obviously.
Really got down to that?
It did, yeah.
And then you did what the audience voted on?
I did, yeah.
Now
I tended to agree. I was about 55%, sing me and 45 minutes.
Now you see why I said that this is a slippery slope. I mean, where could this go, Jeremy?
It would probably go to me singing novelty songs and, I don't know.
I mean, you're really using a focus group in some ways. You know that.
Yeah, sure.
Ooh, music by focus group. Isn't that exactly what you're trying to get away from?
Yeah, to a point. But you know what? You got me.
It might be a good time to sing something.
Yeah, let's do
that. How about
that?
Yeah. All right. You're listening to Jeremy Messersmith in the Maud Moon Weyerhaeuser studio. This is Mid-Morning.
This is Tucson Gray, First in Life and Death.
Racing up and down the halls, footsteps echo off the walls. Summertime is here again, and I'm not thinking of the friends I leave behind. No one wants to be the last one home. Bell rings out at 3 o'clock. I fly out of the starting block. I may be small, but I've got speed. Trailer sparks behind my feet. No let go of the walls. The summertime is here again, and I'm not thinking of the friends I left behind.
That's Jeremy Messersmith in the Maud Moon Weyerhaeuser studio, along with Brian Tai and Andy Thompson. The new album is called The Reluctant Graveyard. Jeremy, back out on a national tour tomorrow. Thanks.
Thank you.
We have an online question here, and I should tell our listeners this morning, if you'd like to send in some online questions, mprnewsq.org, and click on Send Us a Question. And Jeremy is on the lookout for pranksters. So.
Yeah, yeah. Please, no pranks.
And you know who you are. You know who we're talking about. Online here from Greg, who says, I hear a lot of Turtles in your sound. Were they any sort of an influence on you?
Yeah, actually, they were. Actually, a lot of the bands from the 60s were a big influence. So,
like who else?
The Zombies, the Kinks, the Turtles. Stones, you know, all the bands. But I actually made a little, before we started recording, I remember I made like a little YouTube mix for Brian and Andy and sent it over. And I think there was a Turtles tune on there.
What was it?
I think it wasn't Happy
was
Together.
Was it Happy
the,
Together?
Yeah, the big, big Turtles one.
Great song.
It's such a great vocal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really good.
So, and the Beatles, too.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah,
obviously
the Beatles,
a big
right,
influence.
Yeah. How could I forget the
what
Beatles?
What were you listening to as you were preparing to record?
All those bands.
But Beatles.
Yeah, the Beatles. Yeah. Oh, what was I listening to of the Beatles? I tend to prefer kind of their more psychedelic. So Sgt. Pepper's is probably one of my favorites. And then I do like Let It Be, too, though. So I listened to a few of those. I also listened to a lot of Camera Obscura. They're a band from Scotland, and they do kind of chamber pop stuff. And some Belle and Sebastian. I think those were kind of the big ones.
You know, when I was reading some previous interviews that you'd done, and you were talking about some of the music that you're listening to in different parts of your career, I spotted Al Green, and there's an interesting similarity kind of to his career in music and the Church and your career, and we'll get to that in a minute. But,
sure.
But tell me about Al Green.
Well, Al Green is probably one of my favorite singers of all time, and he can sing anything. I mean, he can literally sing anything, and he can wring so much meaning out of it. It's like his voice has so many layers and sort of voices within a voice. It's like, you know, he has kind of like his sultry kind of thing, and he also has like kind of the church boys singing too. But whatever it is he's singing, he's incredibly sincere about it, and he just sells it. He just sells it in a way nobody else does.
And in a way, in this song, is probably a great example of that. Let's listen. There's also something so easy but also convincing about the way he delivers those lines.
Absolutely. It's like, it's not hard for him at all, is the feeling that I get. Like, it's just, he's the coolest cat in the room. He's got to be.
You feel like you have some of that ease, or that that's something that you get, I don't know, you know, years into a career.
I think it's something you have to earn with the years in a career.
You earn that.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's sort of it's more just like an inner bearing and confidence, I think. And I think that only comes with time.
Now, so what's interesting about his career, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners know this, is the career in music and then the decision that he really didn't want to be involved in secular music and turn back to the church. You, on the other hand, grew up in a fundamentalist church. Can I say that?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And then kind of turned to secular music.
Yeah, yeah, I kind of did. And it's not like it's an overnight thing. It was kind of a gradual process. But I remember growing up and I wasn't really allowed to listen to secular music as a kid. Yeah, so, you know, I I still harmonize or learn to harmonize from, you know, hearing the old ladies behind me in church harmonizing with with hymns and things. And I don't know. I remember asking one time, like, well, why can't I listen to this? And I remember my parents' sort of excuse was, well, you know, really the best music is church music anyway, so that's not even music.
You're not missing anything.
Yeah, you're not missing anything. We know, you know.
So what was the first, do you remember then what the first album or secular kind of music that you heard?
I remember I had a summer job sort of pulling weeds for my neighbor, and I had a radio, and I tuned it to an oldie station. I was probably 10 or 11 or something like that. And so I remember hearing Day Tripper by the Beatles was sort of especially just completely rocking and mind-blowing to me. But I listened to that oldie station a lot, and I think that my parents thought I was listening to baseball games, which I did too. But.
You know, that's an interesting experience, though, for you, because I don't know if I could pinpoint the first time. You know, in some ways, as you're growing up, if your parents listen to music, it just kind of creeps into your consciousness. That's a very different experience.
Yeah, it was sort of like
it's then and now, kind of.
Yeah, it's a little bit like a, you know, it was a kind of a secret joy, you know, to sort of like be able to sneak around and listen to this amazing music. It just made it all the more intriguing and thrilling to me.
Do your parents listen to your music?
They do, yeah, yeah.
Do they?
Yeah, yeah, they do. I think they have sort of since gotten a little less strict about it, I think, or at least with mine anyway. I mean, they're at shows and things.
What do they, I mean, are there critiques or, you know, any kind of feedback that you get when you send the CD?
No, I don't really get much in the way of feedback, although every once in a while I'll, you know, if we're out someplace, my dad will sort of bust into a lounge version of one of my songs, which is, I think that means that he likes it, I think.
In a satirical kind of way? Or
I can't tell
or
anymore.
Or that's his real rendition of Violet or whatever it is.
I don't know for sure, but I think it means that he likes it enough to maybe poke a little fun at it.
I was interested, knowing your background and religious training that you had in church and then in college.
Yeah,
right.
Sure. Yeah.
Did you study biblical studies in college?
I did. Yeah. I guess the school that I went to, you have to take a certain number of, you know, Bible theology classes. So I guess I sort of minored in biblical studies. Yeah.
So when did the point come when you found yourself turning a bit more towards you know, a secular life?
I had finished up, I was just about done with school, and I had to write a paper on a certain passage of scripture, and I ended up looking at a bunch of commentaries. I don't read Greek, but it appeared that nobody really knows what this particular section means. Like, there's a bunch of maybe scribal errors, or they're not really sure, and that was just a huge sort of shock to me, because a big part of, you know, being a fundamentalist is that, you know, the Bible is the true inerrant word of God, and it's 100% correct. It should be interpreted, you know, literally. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of felt, I was just sort of shocked. And I think that was kind of one of the starting points. And I started sort of rethinking the whole thing. And I think that was the beginning of it, I guess.
So the revelation was there are mistakes in this scripture.
Yeah.
And why would there be mistakes?
What? There's mistakes in this, you know, this is the source of all truth, and there's maybe a, you know, a comma out of place. You know, this is completely shocking. How can this be? You know, I need to rethink everything quick.
And that's what you did.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah, I sort of had to do a whole, you know, all the way back to Descartes, I think, therefore I am, and wow, what do I actually think about things? And yeah, it was kind of a weird couple years. I described it as I had a very strong moral compass that was sort of spinning wildly in all directions for a number of years.
Has it come back to a kind of true north on this, or are you still trying to figure it out?
Well, oddly enough, I still feel like pretty much the same person. The only difference is that I recycle. That's the only difference.
Recycle. Well, how can you be the same person?
I feel like I do all the same stuff I did before. I may have different internal reasons for doing them now, but I'm still pretty much exactly the same.
I'm interested in what your ideas of, or how your ideas of the afterlife might have changed. And of course, you must have been thinking about that when you were writing the music for the newest album.
Well, yeah, that's a big part of it. It's like, what do I think of an afterlife? What do I think of death? You know, I guess I wasn't really sure, and I thought I should really write some songs to sort of, you know, songs are cheap therapy, and it really helps to sort of explore ideas and especially different viewpoints to write about it. So there's one song called John the Determinist on the record, and mm-hmm. it's simply from the perspective of a determinist, this is all there is. Everything is sort of preordained, I guess. what do I think about it? And I guess if I've come to any sort of conclusion, I mean, not that there's really a conclusion, but it's that I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. There could be something awesome, you know, after you die. It could be. I'm tending to think probably not, but, you know.
You're leaning towards death is the end.
Yeah, death is pretty much it. And, I mean, I'd be happy to be surprised. That would be fantastic, but I'm not really planning on it, I guess.
What did the church that you grew up in believe about that?
Oh, yeah, that there's, you know, an afterlife. And
but a very specific concept of what happens when you die, what heaven
would
be like?
Yeah, if you are saved, you go to heaven, and if you're not, then, well, you might have been a good person, but sorry, you're going downstairs.
A very vivid idea of what hell looked like, huh?
Yeah. I mean, the church I grew up in was very, very sort of hellfire and brimstone, like that kind of thing. In fact, I remember my parents telling me that the church that they went to when they became Christians was very much a hellfire and brimstone sermon they heard, and they thought, well, we don't want to go to hell. Who wants to do that? Well, let's get saved. And that was one of the motivations for them.
The preacher would get up in this church and talk about what it would be like to go to hell.
Oh, absolutely.
In very specific terms.
Absolutely. I mean, it was it wasn't like in every Sunday, but maybe every other Sunday. you know, and there's the passage in Revelation, I think, where he talks about, you either need to be hot or cold, and if you're lukewarm at all, if you're a lukewarm Christian or believer, then hey, sorry, but you're going downstairs too.
So, Jeremy, do you think that you can be a believer without believing in life after death? I mean, have you figured that out?
I have no idea. I have no idea if you can be a believer. I mean, I'm assuming so, because I'm assuming people can be, but I guess I don't really know.
How about another song?
Okay, let's do that.
All right, great. Jeremy Messersmith is in the Maude Moon Weyerhaeuser studio with us this morning. Goes out on national tour tomorrow. If you have any online questions, nprnewsq.org, and click on Send Us a Question. What are you playing?
This is Organ Donor.
Tongue in the my spine at the wedding chapel full of people feet turning into land lost and leg at the iron foundry where they found me dead. They drained my blood at the mortuary, no more worry ice, water in my veins, took my bones to the cemetery where they still remain.
Think you're going to keep going when you end that.
We probably should.
You know, no, don't. Or do, whatever you want. Jeremy Messersmith here in the Mod Moon Warehouser studio with Andy Thompson and Brian Tye. These guys going out on tour with you?
No, two? Unfortunately.
Oh, you're leaving them behind.
Yes,
okay.
I am.
Hey,
sorry,
some,
guys.
Some really, you know, vivid images in that song. A good follow-up to what we were just talking about before. But so give me the details. Where'd it come from?
Well, I, for the longest time, I just had a line, I was born in a mortuary, and,
that
I
was rattling around in your
yeah,
head.
Yeah, I was just kind of stuck on it for a long period of time, and then I thought, you know, it'd be kind of fun to sort of, I had an idea for this tune, eventually called Organ Donor, and I, that sort of popped up, and I was like, well, what if we had a character who, you know, sort of lost things throughout life. I was kind of inspired by, I used to work in a grocery store. And I remember that I was like 16 at the time, I believe. And my job was to basically haul all the really big, heavy boxes because I was the one who had a young back that could that could haul this stuff. And apparently everyone else had thrown their backs out at this job. And so I just kind of like the idea of... you know, as you sort of go through life, maybe things are sort of taken from you. You know, like there's a tollway.
Oh, okay. I was going to, organ donor working in the grocery store boxes, connection there.
Oh, I guess it was just, I don't know. You just give away things as you go through life. And it was actually, I should clarify, losing your spine in the wedding chapel. That was actually my wife's idea. Thanks for that.
Does she? Is there actual writing collaboration with your wife? Because I've heard that you run a lot of the lyrics by her.
I do. She doesn't really write stuff for me per se, but she is the person I wake up at 3 a.m. You know, like, what do you think of these lyrics? How does this sound to you? Does this work? Is this terrible? I don't know what I'm doing anymore. And she is sort of the first person I bounce ideas off of, which is pretty great.
Are you, you said that you had that line for a while and then you were trying to figure out where does the song go from there. So are you jotting down lines like that in some kind of a notebook or where do you keep them and then what do you do with them?
I usually end up, I do most of my writing sitting in bed with my laptop. And I usually just kind of sit there.
You write
there.
On a laptop, really?
I do, yeah. I sit there and, well, usually because I can be distracted and do other things and, you know, I can, you know, surf the internet or whatever instead of writing. But, yeah, I usually sit there and I usually do my best stuff in the morning, generally.
Uh-huh.
I'll wake up and type for a few hours and see if any good ideas pop up.
You know, it's hard for me to imagine you doing this, you know, on a computer. I don't know why. I just picture that this is more of a more intimate process, that it's pen to the paper.
Sure.
But
well,
no.
I do use both. I do carry around notebooks and things with me. That ends up being sort of like initial inspiration, but I do probably 75% of the writing, or more importantly, the editing on a laptop. Editing is just a lot easier on a computer.
How many revisions will the songs go through then? How long is the editing process?
Well, Organ Donor, I probably did 5 or 6 revisions. I mean, I do tend to revise stuff a lot. I mean, songwriting is really condensed. You don't really have a whole lot of space to say what you want to say, so you really have to make every word count.
You know, that's like poetry.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But I tell me if this is true. I think I read in an interview that you did not like poetry very much. Dan Wilson was the one who introduced you to it.
I was complaining when I was making my second record with Dan Wilson, who produced it. I was complaining that I just don't get poetry. I never read it. And he was like, well, you know, there's some good poetry out there. I'm like, bah. What are you talking about? And he said, here, take this. It's a Spoon River anthology. Mm-hmm. I think you might like it. You know, I'm like, okay, I'll give it
a try. Masters, right?
Yeah, Greeley Masters. And I did end up loving it. It was fantastic. It was a huge inspiration.
So how is it, though, that you would not see the connection between songwriting and poetry? I mean, how would you not like poetry?
Well, I think it was just I didn't really grow up reading poetry, and the poetry that I did read, you know, it was sort of like the, you know, English classics, I guess.
You didn't grow up reading it. Was that something else your parents would have rather you weren't exposed to?
No, I don't think so. I think it was just there wasn't much of it around where I grew up. It really wasn't, you know, a big influence. I think I would rather have gone to see a movie or something, you know. And I have since read some poetry, and for everyone out there, and it is quite good. But it's something that apparently I've discovered later in life.
Maybe that's better, right?
Maybe, sure. I mean, I'm constantly finding there's life kind of unfolds and there's really wonderful things about it, and it hasn't stopped yet, so.
I want to ask you about your inspiration, too, because when Dar Williams was here, months ago, she was talking about that even when she's out on tour or when she's at home and she's in one of those, I need songs, where am I going to get the inspiration for this? Mm. She'll go into an art museum and cruise around and look at the paintings and the sculpture and jot down fragments of ideas from that.
Sure. I think the important thing is to be sort of, for me, is to be plugged in and just engaged, whatever that means, and pursuing whatever is interesting me. You know, yeah, art museums, fantastic. I do watch a lot of films. From the news, I've written songs from just about anything you can imagine.
From the news?
Oh yeah, sure, absolutely. Mm. Or, you know, more importantly, when I hear something on the news, maybe that's I have a particularly strong feeling about. That's great fodder for a song.
Yeah, can you think of the last time that happened?
Violet, the song was, I remember watching, a bunch of, Proposition 8 protests out in California and thinking, boy, I think this movement needs a protest song or something, and I should try to write one. Well, I've never written one like that before. That could be interesting. And so that was when I actually wrote most of it sitting on the bus and jotting down that song. Yeah.
Online here from Heidi in Minneapolis, and we've gotten a couple emails about this, about your next gig. Mm-hmm. Seems like you've been traveling a lot. We miss you locally.
Yeah, sorry about that. I've been gone pretty much all summer, and I could just use some time off when I'm at home. It's nice to relax and sort of,
so you don't want to play,
sort of decompress. But I will be back in the fall, and I will play so much around town, you'll be sick of me. I promise.
Do you feel like you lose your bearings when you're on the road too long?
Something like that. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I definitely feel odd. I find, especially if I'm going by myself, I end up talking a lot less. I become even more introverted, if that was even possible. But it's just disorienting, kind of being away from things that are familiar, your support structure or whatever. It's a little odd, and it usually takes a few days before I kind of feel back to normal and I feel like kind of a functional human being again.
When you're back.
Yeah, when I'm back.
You know, it's weird to hear you say you end up talking a lot less because you're in front of audiences. I mean, if anything...
Well, I'm in front of audiences for about 1 hour a day, and the rest of the time, I'm pretty much by myself or, you know, driving long stretches alone in a car, and it tends to just be pretty mellow,
yeah,
pretty boring.
What do you do on the road trips?
Are you
listening to music?
No, not usually. Well, every once in a while. If I get sleepy, I'll put on some music, but generally I go for books on tape and things like that.
I thought maybe you were playing the Star Wars theme.
Oh, well, I mean, of course, you know, I'll listen to maybe Star Wars novels, but...
Wow.
But no, I haven't done that. I will confess, though, I do have it on my iPod just in case.
Just the Star Wars theme?
Yes, just in case.
Well, you don't have to call that out because we have it.
Oh.
Listen to this. We can give you a little CD of that if you want to take it out there on the road.
Thanks. That'd be great.
You are a huge Star Wars fan.
I am, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So does that mean that you can answer just about any trivia question that comes your way?
You know, I do pretty well. Not so much new trilogy, but classic trilogy, I'd say I'm pretty good.
Really? Uh-oh. All right, so I've got a trivia question for you that I had to look up because it's not like I know all this stuff. You ready
all right.
for this?
And if I can't get it, I'm sure Brian over there can help me out.
He's also a huge Star Wars fan?
Yeah, definitely.
Brian, what gives? Why?
I don't know. I mean, just since grade school, I've been hugely into it. I mean, I have every Star Wars figure ever made.
wasn't there a short film that you made?
I've made animated Star Wars figure films.
Brian, you mean where you're like moving the little figures on film?
And then at the end, in big block letters, it says, produced by Brian Ty.
Why would you claim credit for that? No, just kidding. Can our listeners see that?
Yeah.
Find that somewhere online?
I intend to put it on YouTube, so hopefully soon.
So who knows more about Star Wars between you guys? Do you have to give the mantle to Brian?
Well,
I don't know. You're pretty good.
All right. I think I can do it. We'll see.
All right. Here comes the question.
All right.
And Brian, if he's struggling with this, you can jump
in. I'm your lifeline.
My lifeline.
All right.
Yeah.
So here it is.
All right.
The idea for Obi-Wan Kenobi and the Force came to director George Lucas after he read which book? Yes.
Oh,
I've stumped them.
After which book? I wonder if it's a Joseph Campbell book.
Nope.
Oh, no, it isn't. Oh, okay. I don't know then. Anybody? That is a great
Anybody
question.
Anybody bail him out.
And now I'm really curious.
Yeah.
I'm drawing a blank.
Ryan.
Wow.
Andy, no.
We're stumped. I'm curious if anybody out there knows.
Do you think? I know. Well, we've only got a few minutes left in the show here, but should I hold that? I'll hold that.
All right. Just
All right?
for a minute.
Just in case. Okay. Here's the question again for any of you Star Wars fans that want to email in real fast. The idea for Obi-Wan Kenobi and the Force came to director George Lucas after he read which book? It had to be a book question because we're all about books on Mid-Morning.
That makes sense. Tell you what, include your address and I'll send you a record too if you can get it.
The person that gets it?
Yeah.
Great idea.
Let's do that.
Yeah, include your email address, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll email back and then you can send. How about that?
Perfect.
Okay. Here's an online question from Joanne in St. Paul. She says, "Hi, Jeremy from Joe and Joanne."
Oh, hi.
You must know
them.
Hey,
what's up? Yeah.
What is this business about not making records anymore? City Pages. What's the next project?
I don't know what the next project will be exactly.
Well,
but
what is this business? Because I read that, too, in the City Pages interview.
I think I might want to try doing something else. I'm not sure what that is. I'm not sure if that will be a screenplay or a book I'd love to write.
A book of poems? No.
No, probably not. No. If I did write a book of poems, you can bet that no one would ever see it.
What kind of book?
I have a few ideas floating around. it may not be, it may be a comic book. I mean, I don't know. There's a few, I have a bunch of ideas kind of, I have a few ideas floating around that, and I don't want to say what they are because, you know, of course that would completely jinx the entire thing, but that would be really fun, I think.
I think you're more serious about the comic book thing than you're letting on right now, which is a really great idea.
Yeah. I don't want to say too much more.
Tell
but,
us all. It's just you and me and Brian and Andy.
Yeah, it is.
Just
but
us.
I've met some pretty fun, cool people through making music, and I'd like to maybe collaborate with some different fields, including maybe some fashion people and you know, video, some writers, some artists, and some different people.
So does that necessarily mean you'd have to, you know, step away for a while from the music?
Music might be a part of it. I don't know. We'll see. I think the only thing I have planned for to answer Joe and Joanne, this fall when I'm done touring, I'm going to set up a little studio in my house, and I'm just going to play and have fun for a few months and see what ends up happening out of that. But I feel like I'm not sure how much better I can really get at writing pop songs, so I may just want to try something totally different.
Yeah. We're getting a couple answers here, and none of them are right,
to
say. Here from Aaron in Rochester, is it the Bible? No, Aaron. From David in Minneapolis. See, I thought they'd all Google this right away.
Oh, right.
They'd
have me
on this. Yeah. From David in Minneapolis, Siddhartha, no. Mm. Bryson Egan says, I think the book that inspired The Force was Dune. No.
Was an inspiration for the films, but not for
not
this particular
specifically
thing,
the idea of The Force. And Sally in St. Paul says, Star Wars trivia, Lord of the Rings. That's a good guess, but no.
Hmm. Yeah, wow, I can't believe it.
Isn't this great?
Yeah.
We have very smart people in the audience.
Yeah,
really.
I'm very surprised by this,
actually.
Here's
Sam in St. Cloud who's saying Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress. No, very good guess, though. But no. And you can all check me on this when I finally give Jeremy the answer, which I'm going to do in just a couple minutes.
Is it the Bhagavad Gita?
No. Good guess. Here's Mark in Burnsville, the hero with 1,000 faces.
I was thinking the Joseph Campbell.
Were you thinking about that?
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
But no, I guess not.
No, it's not. Here's Aaron in Blaine, 1963 abstract film by Arthur Lipset.
Wow.
Never heard of it.
I don't know it, but...
But Aaron, no.
Hmm.
That's not it.
This is amazing.
especially because this was all just, all right, what kind of trivia can I come up with?
Sure, and you've stumped a whole ton of people this morning.
I was interested in whether you had read, because of your interest in Star Wars, whether you had read the Lord of the Rings.
Oh,
Tolkien's,
yeah.
Tolkien's novels. And
I mean, my nerddom isn't strictly limited to Star Wars, so I did read the Lord of the Rings like every year for... Well, probably most of my teenage years.
Did you?
Years,
every
think.
Year?
Yeah, every year. Yeah.
I had a hard time getting through them.
Well, it can be a little dry when he's talking about, you know, landscape stuff for a while.
Pages and pages.
Yeah, pages and
exactly.
pages.
Exactly. So you know we talk a lot about books. Okay, we've got Carrie and Duluth saying The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe or Wizard of Oz. No, Carrie. Mm. And Chuck saying C.S. Lewis. Another good guess. Mm-hmm. Paralandra. No.
Oh, the space trilogy, C.S. Lewis.
That's not it. You've read those?
Yes, yes. Mm. I've read just about everything by C.S. Lewis, I think.
I'm going to ask you to play us out in a minute here,
cool.
But I would like to know about, you know, a book that has been influential from you, and maybe we've named them already.
Oh, you know, there's one book I really liked in particular, and it was called The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Haruki Murakami. He's probably my favorite author. I've read everything that he's done, and I can't even tell you what it's about because it's so strange. He writes these sort of metaphysical, I don't know, thriller sort of books.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but that's probably one of my all time favorites.
We'll put that on the mid-morning book list.
It's
we'll see how many
the
people
reason,
pick
the
up
reason
on
I like it is because the protagonist in every single book is pretty much always the same, and he's basically me for the most part. So tends to be this sort of 20-something dude who's not especially motivated and spends a lot of the time, you know, kind of like wandering around and then cooking. And sort of the plot seems to happen. Yeah, pretty much. The plot sort of seems to happen around him, and he's just sort of very passive, and he just sits around, and I'm just like, wow, every book I pick up by this guy, I'm like, I wonder what I'm going to do in this book. This is going to be fantastic.
So here's the name of the book that George Lucas was influenced by. Let me say thank you very, very much for being here. Guys, thank you very much for coming.
You.
And good
thank
luck
you.
On the tour.
Thanks.
Here's the name of it. Carlos Castaneda's Tales of Power.
Really? Interesting. All right, that's going on my my book list.
And on ours, too.
This is Violet.
Streaks of earth matted in her hair, beaten down, but she won't scare. Blinks her eyes, battered green and blue. Ignorance can leave an awful. Fist sets a jar. No, she won't quit. She'll take the fight to streets and avenues. A little dirt can make a flower.
Minnesota Public Radio's 89.3 The Current for a breath of fresh music. From Willie Nelson to Ryan Adams, Bob Marley to Bob Mould, The Stones to The Strokes. Every day deserves a soundtrack. 89.3 The Current. Great music lives here.